Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
President-elect Donald Trump is no fan of the nation's intelligence services. Mr. Trump has called the CIA's finding that Russian hackers tried to influence the outcome of the presidential election ridiculous. He has nominated a national security advisor, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, who says the CIA is a political tool of the Obama administration. And he has scoffed at the idea that he needs the daily intelligence briefings prepared for every president since Kennedy.
You are getting the presidential daily brief only once a week.
Well, I get it when I need it.
But is there some skepticism?
First of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The fact is, if they are doing their jobs right, intelligence agencies will inevitably discover information that the White House is loath to hear, any White House. But my guest believes it's of critical importance that the president, any president, is open to such information and willing to consider facts that conflict with his preconceived notions. Joshua Rovner is chair of international politics and security at National Security at SMU. His recent article, Will Team Trump Politicize Intelligence, appears on the website War on the Rocks, and he's the author of the book Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. Joshua, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Since you suggest it's a dangerous idea to politicize intelligence, what does that look like in practice?
So politicization refers to attempts to manipulate intelligence so that it reflects policy preferences. If you're a policymaker and the intelligence community brings you a piece of analysis and you don't like it, you can choose to ignore it, or you can try to bend the intelligence community to your will to make it say what you want to hear. And that can have really, really damaging effects on the quality of intelligence and on the long-term health of intelligence policy relations.
Is there evidence that the intelligence community in the United States is more likely to lean with one political party than the other?
So there have been a lot of accusations of that over the years. Going back to the 1960s, conservatives, especially hardcore Republican conservatives, have believed that the CIA tends to go to the liberal side, and they tend to align themselves with Democrats. This goes back to Richard Nixon, who was very, very dubious of the CIA and thought that it was sort of a bastion for Northeastern liberal elitist. That kind of reputation has lingered throughout the years. It was very powerful in the 1970s and debates about the Soviet Union. And it's returned today, where you see Republican partisans being very skeptical of the CIA and implying that it is acting against the president-elect.
So Nixon outsourced a lot of the dealings with the CIA to National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. Did this give Kissinger more power than others in his position had had?
Kissinger probably had more power than any other national security advisor has ever had. Kissinger was a remarkably well-positioned person in the Nixon administration, both because of his personal relationship with President Nixon, but also because he built the National Security Council staff into sort of his own private intelligence analysis bureau. Kissinger and Nixon really believed that they could do intelligence analysis by themselves with the NSC staff and didn't need to rely on the CIA or anyone else.
But did Nixon work well with the people who were reporting to him?
Nixon worked well with a very small inner circle. And even at that point, it was very contentious. A lot of this had to do with Nixon's own personality. He did not think highly of intelligence leadership. He didn't think very highly of the director of Central Intelligence. He tried to keep the DCI out of NSC meetings. It was a very cold and distant relationship.
Why does politicizing intelligence make it harder for the agencies that are charged with collecting facts and reporting them to the president, make it any harder to do that? Most of them will not actually, stand before the president and present this information.
Three things happen when you politicize intelligence. The first is that intelligence estimates become too sure of themselves. Usually when there is a complicated and contested international event, answers vary on the question. This is what you should expect. Otherwise, why bother asking them in the first place if the answer was obvious? But when presidents intervene to politicize intelligence, they usually want certain responses. And that leads you to answers that are presented with unrealistic certainty. So that's the immediate problem is that in the medium term, you have a problem because intelligence agencies who have been politicized don't want to revisit their earlier findings. Having gone public with very clear judgments, they don't want to reassess their findings. To do so would essentially be admitting their earlier mistakes, and nobody wants to do that in public. And in the long term, politicized intelligence is really, really harmful because it damages intelligence policy relations for years and decades. People in Washington have very long memories, and they have even episodes dating from the 60s and 70s continue to pervade these discussions about what the CIA is and how it should operate and how it should work with the president. So when you have episodes of real intelligence policy breakdown, you see the effects going on for long after the fact.
Help me understand this. What could the potential benefit be to a president who comes into office already hostile to and dismissive of the intelligence community? Is this about potentially setting them up to take the fall if something goes wrong?
I don't see much benefit in that in terms of setting up the intelligence community as a fall guy. I mean, I imagine that's possible. I don't know how it really helps anybody in the long term. Ultimately, presidents are responsible and accountable to voters. Right, so it's hard for them to simply use intelligence agencies to shift the blame away from their own mistakes. That said, there's a lot of trouble that can come from this kind of very toxic relationship. Even if it's simply the president deciding to ignore the intelligence community because he doesn't believe in anything that it's saying, he's going to lose out. He's going to lose out on valuable information that he can't get from other sources, right? And he's also going to lose out on a check on his own assumptions and beliefs, and he'll trust his gut.
Where would the president-elect get information if not from the nation's intelligence services?
Any president coming into office is going to have his own network, his associates, his colleagues, his family and friends, his own business contacts in the case of President-elect Trump. There's always a wide constellation of people who are providing advice and are eager to provide information and advice to the president. And the president has wide discretion about who he listens to. There's no legal responsibility to pay attention to the CIA or the NSA or anyone else in the intelligence community. He can simply trust his friends and contacts, his informal advisors, his officials through other parts of the administration, or again, he can just rely on his own instincts and his own experience.
The president-elect has noted that, 9/11 happened and then the intelligence community guessed wrong, presented incorrect information about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which, of course, weren't even related to the 9/11 attacks. Mm-hmm. He's got a point there. What can we draw from the lessons learned after the Iraq war?
I think the Iraq story is really important and really instructive, but not for the reasons that Trump says it's important. I think what happened is that if you look at intelligence up until the summer of 2002, that is the summer before the war, the community itself was very divided on basic questions about Iraqi capabilities. There was no agreement on whether or not they had these weapons, what kind of weapons, how many there were. And there was a lot of doubt. So we know from declassified estimates that there were people were always saying, we don't have very much information. We can't be too confident about these findings either way. The Bush administration started leaning on intelligence in the summer of 2002 to make the case that Iraq actually did have these capabilities because the Bush administration was trying to sell the case for war. It's trying to mobilize public support, mobilize congressional support, and it turned to the intelligence community essentially as a public relations vehicle to help it make the case. Once it succeeded in politicizing intelligence, the whole content and tone of intelligence changed. There became certain estimates that Iraq, in fact, did possess these terrible capabilities. And the previous indications of doubt and disagreements and uncertainty about information sort of washed away, right? So the intelligence community certainly made mistakes before the war, but its mistakes were compounded by policy pressure. And if the and if Trump believes that the only story about Iraq is that the intelligence community screwed up, therefore it's untrustworthy, well, he's missing a big part of the story and a very dangerous part of the story.
Is there a distinction between policy pressure that comes from the White House or other leaders and those leaders simply saying to the intelligence services, look, you saying vaguely this may or may not be true isn't good enough. I need more specificity.
There is legitimate criticism from the White House and illegitimate criticism, right? Healthy intelligence policy relations don't require policymakers to move in lockstep with whatever intelligence is telling them, right? They should be critical in the best sense of the term. They should be good skeptics. They should be able to demand that intelligence agencies sharpen their analysis or answer unanswered questions. The problem is when they cross the line beyond from becoming good, skeptical consumers of intelligence into badgering intelligence officials and badgering intelligence agencies to deliver predetermined conclusions. That's where you go from being a good consumer and a good part of this relationship to really a bully.
Is there a Trump doctrine yet?
There is not a Trump doctrine in terms of his foreign policy. The problem with trying to understand Trump's foreign policy is that he usually contradicts himself. I went back over the summer and did a review of his major positions on important national security issues and international issues. And he routinely did a 180 on his attitudes towards the Middle East and terrorism and all sorts of other things. The only consistent position he seems to have is that he doesn't like international organizations. He thinks that they restrict American power and American
NATO, the UN, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but it's hard to find much consistency in his view. The other thing worth watching, however, is that Trump seems to treat foreign policy and diplomacy as a kind of business. Right? He seems to, and this theme comes up again and again, where doing diplomacy is akin to making a business deal. Right. And I think the decision to choose Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State actually is consistent with that belief. So.
Does he do business deals the way a lot of us like to buy cars, which is that no matter what that car cost us, we have to walk out of there feeling as if we got the best of the salesperson?
Again, it's hard to know this in advance, right? There's doing a real estate deal in New York, and then there's trying to forge a diplomatic agreement with an adversary. The purposes of these two kinds of deals are fundamentally different. The purpose of a business deal is to maximize the money you get and maybe the emotional satisfaction of the deal itself. The purpose of diplomacy is to secure national interest for as long a time as you can. Right? It's much broader. The results are much more dubious. The results are much more ambiguous about what you hope to achieve. It will be interesting to see Trump's actual approach to doing diplomacy, but he seems to start with a very strong position. His statements about China particularly, he's starting with a very high offer, a 45% tariff, for instance, and maybe he'll use that as a sort of standard negotiating tactic and he comes down to some middle ground. But a lot is to be determined here, right? His statements have been so wildly inconsistent for the last year that it's hard to ascribe a single doctrine to Trump or to make any sure predictions of what he'll be doing.
We're speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner, Chair of International Politics and National Security at Southern Methodist University. His article, Will Team Trump Politicize Intelligence, appears on the website War on the Rocks. He's the author of a book called Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, join us now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can find us on Twitter at KERAThink or email think at KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner, who chairs the Department of International Politics and National Security at SMU. He's the author of a book called Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. Recently, he published an article called Will Team Trump Politicize Intelligence? If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Joshua, could Mr. Trump's dismissal of the CIA's findings on Russian interference in the election damage his legitimacy to a greater extent than a call for a thorough investigation?
I think that the answer is yes. I mean, I think he's already damaged his reputation within the intelligence community. The idea that Russia was meddling in the election is really not controversial. And it hasn't been controversial for a long time. This has been widely reported going back more than a year now. It's not something that requires a deep secret knowledge. We can trace Russian activities using cybersecurity forensic technology. I don't think that there's sort of any doubt that Russia was involved. Now, why Russia was doing what it was doing, who it was targeting, that's open to some debate. But the baseline idea that Russia was involved is not controversial at all. And in fact, it's consistent with decades of practice. The Soviet Union and then Russia afterwards has been using what it calls active measures to try to influence foreign elections for a long, long time. The fact that Trump would just dismiss that out of hand was probably shocking to intelligence leaders and sort of working intelligence officers on a day-to-day basis. Not just that he would dismiss something that's so readily apparent, but that he would use that as an opportunity to take a backhand shot at the intelligence community, for instance, by bringing up the war in Iraq and by saying, you know, why should we trust these agencies? They're the ones that screwed up in the past. Not good for morale, to put it mildly.
Does his dismissal of the affair suggest to Russia that future attempts to interfere will be possible, if not openly tolerated?
I think that Russia is going to do what Russia is going to do. Right? I think that this is common practice in Russia going back a very long time. I think that Russian foreign policy and that Russian intelligence activities are not that sensitive to changes in how American leaders speak about Russia. I think we give ourselves a bit too much credit on manipulating, you know, what Putin is going to do. Putin's going to do what Putin's going to do for his own reasons. So I don't think it's going to have a huge effect. Now, in your second question about whether or not Trump should get behind some sort of public inquiry about Russian activities, this is more difficult, right? Because there is a very understandable desire to have sort of a 9/11 commission style big public investigation of this. But we really should be cognizant of the dangers of such an investigation. Russian activities have been, above all else, trying to sow doubt among the American public about the strength of its own institutions. I worry about the effect of having a big public investigation about how weak our institutions actually are.
Because
how
then
vulnerable.
What happens?
Right, yeah. Right. Because how vulnerable are we really? I'm not sure that that's necessary and that we should handle it with great care, especially because we have so much open source information about what's gone on from multiple reports going back again for many, many months.
What does President-elect Trump's nomination of Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor suggest about the relationship that the Trump administration intends to have with the intelligence community?
It's not a good sign. Mike Flynn has a very checkered past with the intelligence community. He won rave reviews for what he did in Iraq when he was working with General McChrystal, and they were trying to take down al-Qaeda's network in Iraq during the high point of the Iraqi Civil War. From all accounts, incredibly competent and effective at this very narrow task of finding terrorist networks and trying to take them down. The problems started to arise later. When General Flynn arrived in Afghanistan, one thing that he did was write a report about intelligence while still in uniform and published it through a think tank in Washington. And the report itself took some shots at the CIA and took shots at civilian intelligence in general. When General Flynn became director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, apparently, at least according to some reports, his leadership was quite toxic, where he brooked no dissent, that he was very hostile to his subordinates who would challenge him, and that he created a mood that was not tolerant of dissent. This is not the sort of behavior that you expect from an intelligence leader. You would want somebody who would sort of encourage dissent and encourage arguments in the best sense of the word. Apparently, that wasn't going on when he was director. He was somewhat of a stern figure there. Trump may not have any of these considerations in mind for appointing General Flynn. He might not have been thinking about intelligence at all when he was making this choice. But if he was, it suggests that Trump expects to hear confirming information from the community, right? And that dissent and sort of a free and vibrant analytical atmosphere won't be tolerated. And that's something to be very nervous about.
Well, as to these reports that General Flynn, as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, told his staff, the first thing you need to know is that I'm always right. Mm-hmm. If President-elect Trump was aware of those comments, maybe that sounded to him, as it does to many people who really like Mr. Trump, that reads like a statement of confident leadership. Why does it concern you, and what's the difference between confident leadership and I'm always right?
There's a difference between leading a military organization which requires obedience to commands and leading an intelligence organization which is supposed to cultivate creative analysts who are supposed to read information as best as they can and interpret it to the best of their abilities. Right? If you treat an intelligence agency as you would a military command requiring a clear hierarchy in which orders are delivered and acted upon, or if you treat intelligence like a business where everybody must do the boss's bidding, then you're not going to get very nimble analysis. You're not going to encourage the kind of creative analysis which might lead to better estimates. And at worst, it might lead people to defect from the intelligence community. Right. If I was an analyst and I worked in that kind of agency, I might say, why am I doing this? Right. I'm a smart person. I could probably make more money on Wall Street or in Silicon Valley or anywhere else. I don't want to work here. And they might leave. So if this attitude pervades the intelligence community, that this is the new boss and this is the new regime and you're going to have to get used to it, you might have a tough time retaining your very best analyst.
All right, let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email us at think@kera.org. We have Robert calling from Plano. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest thinks that after Seth Rich leaked the documents, whether there would have been the same call for an investigation if Hillary had won.
There's always going to be a call for an investigation, right? And no matter who leaks documents, if they become clear and they become sort of a political firestorm, there's going to be demands for investigations and inquiries. This is sort of what we do now. We do lots of postmortem investigations. People will partisans from either side will take these opportunities for trying to beat up the other side or demanding some inquiry to get at the real answers, so to speak. The question from my point of view is this good for American national security? And I worry that it's not. Right. There are three big things that we would like to see happen to strengthen intelligence for national security. One is so restoring the credibility of the intelligence community with policymakers. Right. Policymakers need to believe that these agencies are nonpartisan, that they're impartial, that they're objective, and that they're not just another bureaucratic roadblock or political opponent. The second thing we need to do is boost public faith in the intelligence community, right? The public has come to view intelligence in some respects as incompetent, like the failure of 9/11, the failure of the Iraq War, and so forth. And for a long time, the intelligence community has received sort of a special dispensation from the public. All of the other agencies of government we require to be open and accountable and transparent, but the intelligence community gets to be secret because of the nature of its work. Well, the public might not give that special dispensation if it really believes that the intelligence community is not competent. So we need to work on restoring public faith. And the third thing we need to do is restore professional morale within the intelligence community. Again, to get to our last point about being able to recruit and retain the very best people to try to understand a very, very complex world and a really complicated set of challenges to national security. The more that you call for these kinds of investigations and inquiries, and this becomes a normal part of life in Washington, and the less that you can insulate the intelligence community from the political fray, the harder it is to achieve those three big goals.
Do intelligence careerists get to weigh in on the nominations of people like Mike Flynn and the nominee for the director of the CIA, whose name is on a piece of paper
Mike
here.
Mike Pompeo.
Thank you, Mike Pompeo. How much input do members of Congress want from the people who will be working with these individuals?
Well, Congress has a number of ways to ask those questions. So we have intelligence committees in both the Senate and the House, and they both have professional staffs who are very competent, very capable, and they know how the institutions work quite well. So they can reach out to their colleagues and solicit their opinions, either in formal committee hearings or just by picking up the phone and talking. Usually this is the job of Congress to reach out, though, because there's a longstanding sort of informal prohibition on intelligence officials, for obvious reasons, reaching across and saying, hey, let me give you my political advice. And there's a good reason for that.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joshua Rovner, who is author of a book called Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go now to Joyce in Houston. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I have worked in corporate, in government, and I've owned a business now for 24 years. The protocol, the strategy, what the results for a good outcome are all very different. Could your speaker, your expert, talk about some of the real downsides and issues that we as the public need to be looking for when some of these attitudes about intelligence could impact us seriously, nation to nation?
Are you talking about, Joyce, how corporations will be affected by intelligence?
No, I'm saying Trump has worked primarily as a businessman. That's one aspect of being able to do a professional job and measure things. If you measured it, if he worked in a corporation, he would have measured his success in a very different way if he weren't the boss.
Okay. Yeah, very different arenas, Joshua.
It is, and unfortunately, this is always going to be frustrating. In business or in sports or in other walks of life, it's much easier to measure results. In business, you measure results according to the bottom line. Are you making money or are you losing money? In sports, you measure results based on how many points you put on the board versus the other team. In national security, it's much more difficult to measure results. Right, because politics doesn't end. You don't have sort of the end of the fiscal year. You don't have the Super Bowl. Politics just goes on. So it, rather than solving security problems once and for all, you try to manage them. You try to keep them at a low boil. You try to maintain security to the extent that you can without needlessly provoking conflict or crisis. Right, and people will always forever argue about whether you've done a good job, whether you haven't done a good job. There's a related problem with intelligence is assessing the quality of intelligence. As a citizen, as a taxpayer, you want to know, like, is the CIA doing its job? Is the NSA really doing its job well? It's very hard to measure that in real time because not only do you have this sort of abstract problem of measuring national security, but a lot of this stuff is necessarily classified. So to sort of understand and assess the quality of intelligence, you really have to start historically at cases in which we know a lot more than about the ones in the present.
This is a little bit of a diplomacy question, but the president-elect has, throughout the campaign and now as he is waiting to be sworn into office, expressed his frustration with the kinds of accommodations that the United States has made to pretty antagonistic foreign powers. You know, we don't necessarily make a lot of threats that we don't follow through on, but we leave a lot of outs for people to go another way. And the president-elect has basically made it clear that when he says something, he's not going to back down on the part of the United States. What message does that send to a power like China, where there really is an important sense not only of its own role in the world and its relationship with the United States and its role in its part of the world, but in this idea that it needs to have dignity in the face of dealing with a major power like the United States?
I think that we sometimes make too much of the idea of reputation for resolve. There is this widely held view in Washington and a sort of this common sense notion that you must stick with your promises, you must enforce red lines, you must present an image of strength if people are going to take you seriously. And with regard to China, the argument is, well, China is going to be more aggressive because the Obama administration backed away from things in the Middle East or put up a red line in Syria and didn't follow through and so forth. So the Obama administration may be seen as weak or irresolute. I don't think that that's going on. I think that what's going on is that China, like Russia, has its own interest, right? China will decide to act in East Asia based on its assessment of the regional balance of military forces and its assessment of the balance of interest. So it's going to, if it does something truly provocative, much more so than sort of stealing a floating drone, it's going to measure U.S. interest in the case itself, and it's going to measure U.S. capabilities in the theater itself, rather than saying, you know, Barack Obama said something about Syria 4 years ago, therefore we can act with impunity. Reputation is not unimportant, but I think sometimes we do exaggerate it.
We're speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner, who is chair of international politics and national security at SMU. He's the author of a book called Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. Recently, he published an article on the website War on the Rocks called Will Team Trump Politicize Intelligence? We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can find us on Twitter at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner. He recently published an article called Will Team Trump Politicize Intelligence on the website War on the Rocks. He's chair of international politics and national security at SMU and author of Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. You can call into the show at 1-800-933-5372. Joshua, President-elect Trump has said he does not care about his businesses. He is happy to hand those off to members of his family or to other people who may have worked for him. At the same time, we have him appearing to retaliate to a negative review of one of his restaurants in Vanity Fair. How would a President Trump need to act after January 20th if an enemy of the United States attacked a Trump-branded property somewhere in the world?
That's a great question. I hadn't thought about it. He might send a late night tweet in response, and
I mean physically attacked.
Oh, you mean physically attacked a Trump brand? If experience is any guide here, he would respond with something strong rhetorically, and he might consider something strong physically. Right. If somebody shot up a Trump Tower or something like that, there is a huge problem with the conflict of interest between Trump's role as president and Trump's role as a global business person. Right? And this is one case in which that might come up. I think that in general, it would be nice if once elected, Trump put aside his Twitter account, right? For a number of reasons. This is no way to conduct diplomacy. This is no way to think about as president. People do listen to your statements closely. You might want to think about them first with some advisors before you go public in this way. And I think more broadly, I've been watching the news closely, as we all have, and Trump has an ability to sort of dominate the news cycle with little tweets. Right? They're very distracting. And it would be nice if we didn't have that distraction so that as a country we could focus on sort of deep, important, long-term issues and not worry about, you know, his feud with Vanity Fair or some other sort of silly Twitter battle.
There is no level of security clearance that the President of the United States does not possess. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Do you know anything about the procedures by which an incoming president is sort of educated about what he or she can say in public?
The incoming president, even while after the election, they start getting briefed by the intelligence community, and they start working with the outgoing administration. The various departments within the administration have large briefing binders that they hand over, and they start educating not just the president but the whole of the incoming administration on how that works. So there's the formal procedures about how do you actually run a government, and then there's the sort of informal learning process. Okay, here's how it goes. So that process has been going on to some extent. Trump apparently has what he calls landing teams that deal with different issues, which have been trying to coordinate with the White House.
Much has been made about the fact that President-elect Trump says he really doesn't need these daily intelligence briefings. It's been noted that what he's receiving is basically what has been perfectly tailored for President Barack Obama, and therefore it may just not reflect the way that Mr. Trump likes to receive his information. When he becomes president, he can have it in any form that he might choose to receive it, right?
Which is totally legitimate. Right? Different presidents have different styles, some very much like written products, some very much like being briefed. I don't think there's anything written in stone that says an intelligence briefing must be at 8 o'clock every day and it must be 3 PowerPoint slides. I mean, presidents are different kinds of leaders and different individuals. I think that the concern about Trump's disregard for receiving the presidential brief isn't so much about the formal problem of not getting it every morning the way that President Obama has, is that it suggests a deeper sort of blithe dismissal of intelligence. Right? It's symbolic of somebody who is maybe too self-confident and too quick to push away people that really could help him do his job.
All right, let's go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Brad calling from Dallas. Hi, Brad.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, great, thank you.
Let me take you off speaker real quick. I just walked into my office.
All right, thanks.
Sorry, it's the first time calling. My question is whether or not, it's Joshua, right, believes that Edward Snowden should be pardoned by Obama before he leaves office, with Trump coming in and his closeness to Putin, and whether or not he believes that what he did was a patriotic act.
Well, thank you for your call, Brett. I don't know if you want to ask, should he, but will he?
Well, he won't. I mean, President Obama is not going to pardon Edward Snowden, nor should he. Edward Snowden released an enormous amount of information about classified intelligence collection programs. And the vast majority of what Snowden released had nothing to do with domestic surveillance, the issues which have dominated the controversy. He released just huge amounts of information on totally legal and legitimate foreign intelligence collection programs. And he seems to have done this with malice aforethought. If you read Snowden's interviews after the fact, he went to this job as a system administrator in Hawaii knowing what he was setting out to do, and he absconded with a great deal of information, and he immediately fled to China, and that should tell you something. He will not be pardoned, and I don't think he should be.
there are people who really are not fans of President-elect Trump that wonder if there is something nefarious going on between the President-elect and Vladimir Putin and the Russian government, if there has been more communication between them than has been made public. How likely is it that an intelligence service that is already at odds with the president-elect of the United States will have the latitude to be on the lookout even for that kind of engagement between lower-ranking members of the Trump administration? If anything, and I don't mean to suggest that it exists, I just mean that people are concerned about this.
I think that the concern is understandable. I mean, it would be nice to, as during the election season, to have been able to look at Trump's financial records and get a sense of how close his businesses were dealing with Russian banks and so forth, because that is, for a voter, that's a legitimate concern. If intelligence policy relations start off in the new administration on as sour a note as I think they're going to, I think that most analysts will be very disinclined from probing anything like that seriously. Probing the sort of relationship between Russia and American business interest, not only because they've got a lot else that they can do, but because it does risk stirring up a very nasty hornet's nest. I think they'd be disinclined from doing anything at whether or not these things really exist.
Is there precedent for people who work in the intelligence services looking at their own careers, maybe, and keeping quiet about things the president doesn't want to hear simply because they're really bucking for a promotion?
Of course. These are human beings. They're not saints. People worry about their careers. They don't want to get fired. Yes, in my book, I discuss this as a kind of a careerism, and it is an opportunity for analysts to either not look at difficult issues or slant them in a way which is politically convenient to their bosses. So again, if you have fears of that on day one, you might be somewhat subdued. This is not going to be a sort of a free and open atmosphere in the intelligence community at all.
Give us some examples of, in modern history, how previous presidents have countenanced news from the intelligence services that they didn't want to hear. How did George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter deal with this sort of information?
So these are all interesting cases. They've tended to change over time. Jimmy Carter came into office, and he had run a campaign explicitly against the CIA. In the mid-70s, this was a time in which the CIA had a really bad reputation for covert action and assassination plots and so forth. And Carter ran on a platform of moving the CIA in a more moral direction and moving American foreign policy in a more ethical direction. It was a very bad time for the CIA. Not only did they try to rein in those things, but they let a lot of senior analysts go. There was a big purge in the analytical community. But apparently, over time, his relationship did improve with analysts, and his foreign policy in some respects changed as well. You see a similar story in the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration came in with some hostility towards elements of the intelligence community. They were sort of on opposite sides of détente with the Soviet Union. Reagan was much more hawkish than some of the analysts within the CIA. And it was apparently quite ugly in the first couple of years, but it slowly improved over time, again, as the administration slowly changed its foreign policy over time as well. George H.W. Bush is one of the great success stories. From all accounts, George H.W. Bush had a very, very strong and healthy working relationship with the CIA.
Not surprising.
Not surprising. He had been director of the CIA in the 1970s. So he had an idea of how the agency worked and what role it was supposed to perform. One thing I should make clear is that this is not the first time that a president has come into office with suspicion or skepticism about intelligence. Right, this goes all the way back to Harry S. Truman, who had skepticism about creating an intelligence service in peacetime. But never before have we seen something quite so open and intense and explicitly hostile as we do today. This one is different in degree and I think in kind as well.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So the fact that Mr. Trump seems to be more openly antagonistic toward the intelligence services is noteworthy, but he is someone that is understood by his supporters and his detractors alike as someone given to hyperbole, right? People recognize that he may say things that he doesn't entirely mean. Is it possible that he intends behind closed doors to work just fine with the people who have been charged with providing him intelligence?
Well, I hope so. I don't know if there's a difference between the public Trump and the private Trump, right? It's very hard to know that. Accounts of his career in business suggest that you get what you see with Trump, and that's part of his appeal, I think, is that there seems to be something authentic about him, right? He tells it like it is and so forth. So, it would be nice if there was a distinction between the public persona and the private leader, but I don't know that there's evidence that such a distinction exists. The other thing to remember is that Trump has no experience in government. Right. Whereas previous presidents have been able to learn how to balance between their public persona and how their private behavior, this is a on-the-job learning for Trump. Right. He hasn't done this before.
You mentioned earlier that when a deep rift is allowed to form between the intelligence community and the White House, it takes a long time mm-hmm. to heal. Why is that the case?
Partly because it reinforces the worst kinds of negative stereotypes that each has of the other. So intelligence officers often fear that policymakers don't really value them, don't want to hear from them, and are big bullies, that they'll only pay attention when they can use them for public purposes to help them win a fight in Washington. Policymakers often view intelligence with some skepticism. Not only is it unclear to them why intelligence analysis is better than their own analysis, but they also worry that intelligence agencies with control of secret information could embarrass them or undermine their policy program in some way. So there's this built-in tension between these two tribes, the intelligence tribe and the policy tribe. When it spills over, when it erupts into a real controversy, it reinforces the worst beliefs about the others. Right. And again, it just takes a long, long time to repair that.
In 30 seconds or so, if you could advise members of the intelligence community who will deal directly with President Trump, how to best connect with him, what's your sense of the best way to do that?
I would advise three things. One is to be very forthright. Right. Not to hold back, not to be combative or argumentative, but be forthright. A second thing that I would advise is to work with staff. Intelligence policy relations aren't simply the relationship between the director and the president. It's the relationship at lower levels, which really, really helps. So reach out. Get to know the NSC staff. Get to know the congressional committees. Try to build a good baseline working relationship. And the last thing I would recommend is try to stay out of public as much as possible. Don't try to play political games. Don't try to get involved in public disputes. I think, as the James Comey story shows us this summer, that usually ends badly.
Joshua Rovner is chair of international politics and national security at SMU. He's the author of a book called Fixing the Facts, National Security and the Politics of Intelligence. Joshua, always an interesting conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Our Twitter handle is at KERAThink. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. Our email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.